Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jeff Clark, President and CEO of Northern California Public Broadcasting, the parent company of KQED San Francisco, and a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I'll be your moderator for today's program. Now it's my distinct pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Steve Forbes. Steve Forbes is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Forbes and Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Magazine, a post he was named to in December 2007. Mr. Forbes previously served as the company's CEO since 1990. Since taking charge at Forbes, he brought the company into the new media world in the mid-1990s, has added elements in the publishing arena to serve executive women, helped investors manage their challenging tracks as they followed the stock market up and down, and has provided his own insights into the world of finance each month under the title Fact and Comment in Forbes magazine. Mr. Forbes has served our country on many fronts during the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He became a household name to American voters during runs for the presidency in 1996 and 2000. As a Republican, and is a staunch proponent of the flat tax system for U.S. taxpayers, as author of the book, Flat Tax Revolution, Using a Postcard to Abolish the IRS. Steve Forbes was born in New Jersey in the late 1940s, graduated cum laude from Brooks School in Andover, Massachusetts in the 1960s, and earned a bachelor's in history from Princeton in 1970. He's been honored worldwide with honorary degrees from a wide range of colleges and universities, served as a member of Princeton's Board of Trustees for a decade, and today is engaged in the community as a member of the Board of the Overseers of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and on the Board of Visitors for the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. Please join me in welcoming Steve Forbes to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for that very nice introduction. Thank all of you for coming out here this afternoon. It is a great honor to be here once again at the Commonwealth Club, especially not as a candidate. It's much more fun being an agitator than an actual participant. Today, I'm going to make some remarks about what is happening to the economy and the elections. Before I do so, in the name of full disclosure, I will reveal to you, as I've done with some of you before, a favorite saying of my grandfather. My grandfather founded our company back in 1917. He was an immigrant to the United States, was one of 10 children, grade school education, very little money, but like millions who came to the United States, he came from Scotland. He had an opportunity to realize his dreams and ambitions. And when he started Forbes magazine, as you would expect, people would ask him, what's going to happen to the economy? What stock should you buy? Where are interest rates going? And things like that. My grandfather, being an honest individual, he would invariably reply, he would say, you make more money selling the advice than following it. So, yeah, I'm sure some of you appreciate that more than others. But in this era of full disclosure and Sarbanes-Oxley and the like, we're square on that front. Well, concerning the economy, obviously, it's now a year old. The thing that is really gripping this country, really has put people in a very anxious mood, is this credit crisis. What in the world is going on here? After all, this thing has been with us for a year. It's like a bad flu or walking pneumonia. We just can't seem to shake the thing. We go through periods of calm, and then the thing comes back again almost every few weeks. Something else drops. And I think it's, first of all, important to put the crisis in context. What's happening with this crisis is not the size per se. If you take the worst case scenario add up all the possible losses that are going to be realized, primarily on the subprime mortgages, but some of these other exotic instruments as well, over the next 2, 3, 4 years, take a worst-case scenario, you can come up with a headline-raising number of an excess of $1 trillion. That is a real big number. But you have to put it in context to see the thing. Now, I hate to keep using numbers, but, hey, you're going to have to suffer through it. But if you take what American households own in stocks, bonds, bank CDs, 401Ks, all the financial assets the American people own, then you subtract out what people owe on their credit cards, on their mortgages, just for a moment. Don't count the value of people's apartments and houses. Just treat mortgages as straight debt. So you have financial assets on the one side, liabilities on the other side, subtract one from the other, and American households are still plus almost $30 trillion. Americans have more financial assets than the rest of the world put together. Now, some people say that's because a handful have it and the rest don't. You know the old joke about Bill Gates. If Bill Gates goes into a bar, the average net worth of the patron goes up to about $1 billion. Not a very meaningful number, even if he's buying the drinks. But if you take median net worth of American households in the last decade, factor out inflation, still up, even with the housing slump over 30%. So then you take what people own in their houses, subtracting out the mortgages, even with the current housing slump, if you take it nationwide as a whole, still in excess of $20 trillion. So you add it up all together, American households, even in the current slowdown, have assets, net assets, in excess of $50 trillion. So you take what's going to be lost in this credit crisis. It's a big number. It's obviously hurt the economy. But if you put it in proportion, it is something we can absorb. We can get through this thing. And if you look at the losses in terms of the size of the economy, what we're probably going to realize, it's going to be less than what was lost when the high-tech bubble burst in 2000-2001, and maybe on the scale of what we lost when the savings and loan crisis hit in the late 1980s and early 1990s. One of the problems with this crisis is the unknowns. Now, a few weeks ago, it's similar to these health warnings that we get from time to time. Several weeks ago, for example, we were told some tomatoes are bad. Turns out none of them were bad. But guess what happened to tomato sales? They just dried up. No one would eat any of the stuff. Occasionally you get warnings that certain bags of spinach may be tainted. Now, maybe only a small amount of spinach that's out there that you shouldn't eat. But guess what happens to spinach sales? No one's going to buy any of the stuff until they know where the bad stuff is. So when the credit crisis hit last summer, just a little over a year ago, on these subprime mortgages and these other exotic instruments, people didn't know what was good and what was bad. And thanks to securitization, which in concept is a nice thing, putting security assets in one package, selling them out so you spread the risk. So if something goes bad, the risk is spread and you don't have one institution taking a disproportional impact. Nice concept. What it meant was that this stuff was spread all over the world. It went everywhere. And thanks to high technology, you could slice and dice these packages. They call them tranches. You can't say slice and dice. That's not sophisticated enough in the financial world. That makes it sound like a late-night commercial. So you call these things tranches, French word tranche. And you divide these packages up into your appetite of risk. So you could have a package of these subprime mortgages. You could own a piece of it that may be worth today 80, 90 cents on the dollar. You could own another piece that's worth 0 cents on the dollar. So this stuff was spread all over the place. A lot of institutions didn't even really realize how much of this junk they had until the crisis hit. So like a bad spinach or bad tomatoes, guess what happens? The system starts to freeze up. You don't know what the other bank has. You may not even know yourself how much bad stuff you have. So as a result, panic takes over. And so this system, every few weeks, somebody finds out they're going to have to take another write-down. So it's not the size per se, it's people didn't even know where the stuff had gone. If you go home tonight, look under a couch, under your bed, you might find a subprime mortgage floating there. It just went everywhere. Now, adding to the crisis is a concept that came in the world in the early 1990s, in the accounting world, called mark-to-market. Now, mark-to-market is one of those concepts that sound very reasonable, like securitization, but it can have unintended consequences. The idea of mark-to-market is if an institution has a financial asset, why you should mark it to market each day. So if it goes up in value, you mark it up on your balance sheet. If it goes down, you mark it down. Now, that's very good for a stock like IBM or General Electric that's traded. You can get prices every second if you want. But with these instruments, guess what mark-to-market means? There is no market. No one wants to touch the stuff. So what is it really worth? You're guessing. Well, now they have computer models that make it sound more sophisticated than a guess, but nobody really knows. There's no experience in these things. So as a result, you have regulators saying to banks, tighten up your lending standards. Well, very good advice 3 or 4 years late, thank you very much. But they're saying, got to mark this stuff down, tighten up. And then accounting professions. Accountants all remember what happened to Arthur Andersen. They're very fearful of lawsuits, so they're telling their clients, mark to market, be conservative. But if you don't have a market, it could be zero. And so you have cases where you have some of these packages that are still money good, they're still functioning, but because no one wants to buy them, guess what? Some institutions may have to mark them down to zero, even though they're not worth zero. They're still functioning. So you have this confluence of the unknowns and mark-to-market. And so as a result, even though you're having some cash losses, a lot of the write-downs that you read about are actually book losses, anticipation. And so you don't know what at the end of the day how much this stuff is, these various tranches are really going to be worth. But when you take a write-down, book write-down, even though cash may still be coming in, that means you have to recapitalize. So banks like Citibank and others are going out to the market. AIG just did it a few weeks ago, recapitalizing, raising new equity, raising new debt, and hurting existing shareholders. So this thing keeps going on, mark-to-market. Now, what will the losses actually be? Merrill Lynch, just a few weeks ago, sold a package of what they call CDOs, 25 cents on the dollar. That was seen as a distressed price. That may be worth 50 cents, maybe worth 10. No one really knows. So it's not the size per se of the crisis. It's the unknowns and the need for recapitalization, which means banks are tightening up on lending, and the thing spirals. Now, this leads to one of the most boring subjects in the world. Brace yourself. I hope you had your Starbucks or whatever it is you drink before you came here. If you're listening to this on the radio, be sure you take a sip of that coffee, because there's no more boring subject than monetary policy, Federal Reserve interest rates. If any of you are single or you have kids or grandkids are single, you're on a bad date, you want to get out of it, politely start talking about monetary policy and the rest of the evening will be yours. If you ever find yourself on an airplane, in coach, in a middle seat, and these days everyone finds themselves in that position from time to time, you're on the runway watching your life pass away, and you want a little elbow room, start talking to seatmates about monetary policy, you'll have all the room you want. But in essence, monetary policy just boils down to the equivalent of having a car, truck, whatever it is you might drive. You can have a magnificent piece of machinery. The bottom line is, if you don't have sufficient fuel, the thing ain't going to move forward. You're going to stall the engine. You have too much fuel, you're going to flood the engine. Just the right amount, you have a chance to move ahead. The same is true of the economy. The economy's fundamentals can be pretty sound. But if you don't have sufficient credit, if the Fed's not creating enough money, economy's going to stall, creates too much money, distortions, inflation's going to come in, just the right amount, you have a chance to move forward in a non-inflationary way. Now, long story short, 4 years ago, the Federal Reserve made a huge mistake. It miscalculated what was happening in the United States economy. They printed far too much money, kept interest rates artificially low. They printed too much money, and we're living with the consequences now. When you print too much money, what happens? We saw this. None of you are old enough to remember the 1970s. Yeah, that's called pandering. I tried it in politics, didn't do me any good, which is why I'm here today. But when you print too much money, too much money's floating out there. The first thing that gets hit is commodities. They're priced in dollars globally. So if the value of the dollar is going down, the dollar price of commodities go up. So in 2004, what happened? Oil started to move up. Copper went up. Lumber went up. Shipping rates went up. Steel prices went up. Heck, even the price of mud went up. Everything was going up, and nobody knew what was happening. Why was this happening? Well, maybe it's India or China, or maybe it's greedy oil company executives. These folks have been in business over 100 years, slow learners, but they finally figured out how to manipulate the market. Dumbbells though they are, took them 100 years. Now, big thing was happening was classic inflation, something we hadn't had since the 1970s and early 1980s. Now, part of what's happened to oil is supply and demand. Part of it, which I'll touch on in a few minutes, is uncertainty about what's going to happen with Iran. But a big part of it is classic inflation. Too much money, dollar price goes up, and it creates huge distortions in the economy. Now, this gets, Federal Reserve makes a mistake. Biggest mistake, domestic mistake of the Bush administration, I think, on the economic side, is their weak dollar policy. When the dollar started to get weak, instead of the Treasury Department calling the Fed behind the scenes and saying, "What are you guys doing? Stop it. This is not good," instead they quietly applauded. They wouldn't admit it publicly, but quietly they liked a weak dollar. Why? Because Treasury Department bureaucracy has this crazy notion that if you weaken the dollar, that'll help exports. You'll hear that in the news. Yes, short term it'll help exports when you cheapen your money. But long-term, it ain't going to help you. And in the short term, you're going to end up paying more for, like, oil, now sending annually $700 billion overseas, whereas it was about $200 billion a few years ago. And domestically, it messes things up, distorts things up. For example, housing. Housing was already booming in the United States as a result of tax changes made in 1998 and demographics. We're one of the few developed countries in the world where the population is still increasing. So though those were sound reasons, but in 2004, when this excess money was created, guess what happens? Lending standards go down. Got to put that money to work. So lending standards go down, new players come in, got to put the money to work, and so you come up with new types of mortgages, like, why have an income? You know, why make a down payment? Why pay principal? Why pay interest? And so the system goes kablooey. And you pay, and eventually the stuff, proverbial stuff, hits the fan. That's what happened last summer. And how did the Federal Reserve respond? Why, they printed more money. Got to deal with the crisis. There's not a shortage of cash in the system today. The problem today is people are clutching the cash out of fear. They don't know where the dollar is going. They don't know what's going to happen in the future. So it's not a shortage of liquidity in the system overall. It is fear that people clutch it and it's not being put to work. But the Federal Reserve keeps responding by trying to print more money. The man who succeeded Mr. Greenspan made the mistake in 2004, is a fellow named Ben Bernanke. He once wrote an academic paper saying the way you deal with the crisis is you print more money, throw money at it. He even made the analogy Friedman did to throwing money out of helicopters, which is why his name inside the Fed is Helicopter Ben. And Helicopter Ben still is throwing the money out there. They refused to tighten up yesterday. So you have a weak dollar, which creates uncertainty, which hurts business investment, and we have the unnecessary mess we have today. So the best thing the Bush administration could do, but I don't think they're going to do it, I've heard Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, speak about it. He doesn't get it, is strengthen the dollar. We've done it before. You do it, our allies would cooperate in a nanosecond of buying up dollars. They don't like a weak dollar. The Federal Reserve can cooperate by just stop printing too many of the dollars, soak up some of the excess money. We've done this before. This is not rocket science. We've been here before. I'm amazed. I'm old enough to remember the 70s and early 80s, and amazed we did the dumb mistakes again. But here we are. Now, how do you know whether this thing is getting better or not? Don't listen to the Federal Reserve. They speak what sounds like the English language, but it's designed to leave a fog of confusion. If you're ever up late at night, not being able to get to sleep, just put on some old tapes of Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chairman, testifying before Congress. It's quite a sight. He does his stuff, and you see the representatives and the senators nod their head like they know what he's saying. Then they read their cards, asking questions that their staff gave them, like they know what they're asking. Some of them get it, but most don't, on monetary policy, and it's quite a sight to see. But just look at the commodity markets, particularly the gold price. It's worked for 4,000 years. We'll give you a good indication of whether they're doing it right or wrong. Right now, gold has come down a little bit, but it's still high, $870, $880 an ounce. If it stays in that range, as they say in an airplane, when you things start get a little choppy, turbulence ahead, tighten the seatbelts. If it stays in that range, just expect more strange things will happen. If it comes down to in the 600, 500 range, they keep it, they don't let it fall below that, we'll be okay. We'll get out of this pretty quickly. So just watch the commodity markets, not what these folks say. Now, step back for a moment. We have this monetary crisis, and in a moment I'm going to touch on the elections. But step back for a moment, and the headlines comparing this to the Great Depression, all that kind of stuff, it is not that bad yet. They may make it that bad if they work at it, but we're far away from that. And look, though, despite this big road bump, at the global economy. And I think you'll realize, even though we have a real crisis right now, we're living in an extraordinary era, one that almost could be characterized as a golden age, given all the limitations of human beings. The trouble with golden ages is you don't realize you're in one until it's over. Why? Because on a daily basis, you're dealing with the frictions of lives, the challenges of life, kids, grandkids, getting the business, getting to work, all of that, and you don't realize what an extraordinary era this is. But until the credit crisis hit last summer, in recent years, we've been in a period of history where never before have so many people in so many parts of the world advanced so quickly economically as happened in recent years. India, China, Eastern and Central Europe, even parts of Africa and Latin America starting to move ahead. And you take Eastern and Central Europe, not much in the headlines, but that region as a whole has been growing faster than the Asian region as a whole. So this is a phenomenal global phenomenon, literally hundreds of millions of people starting to move into the middle class. Even the U.S. economy, even all the abuses we've put on the thing, it almost reminds you of, some of you may be old enough to remember, Rodney Dangerfield. The Economist talked about getting no respect. But between 2003 and 2007, the U.S. economy's expansion, just the growth alone, exceeded the entire size of the Chinese economy. We grew the equivalent of China in a little over 4 years. Now, obviously, China's growth rates are higher, but they're coming off of a much smaller base. So in the U.S., between 2003 and 2007, created more jobs than Western Europe and Japan put together. And this in spite of real challenges like Washington. Washington's fiscal policies on the spending side have been compared their spending, both Democrats and Republicans responsible for this thing, to drunken sailors, which, of course, is an insult to drunken sailors. Drunken sailors are spending their own money, not yours. But put it in context. If we get this thing right on the monetary side, relearn central banking, maybe we should do a book, Central Banking for Dummies, and send it to the Fed and some of these other central bankers. Get that back on track again. Don't make big mistakes on the tax side. This thing will recover fairly quickly. I mentioned household assets in the United States, pretty good. Inventories in the U.S. economy today, outside of housing, rock bottom. There's a lot of spring left in this economy if we just get over this temporary crisis. Now, this leads to a few comments about the elections, then we'll get to the Q&A. People, I don't have to tell you, are anxious, and many of them are angry. Fluid situation, patterns of the past not quite working, which is why the poll results are all over the place, depending on the week. States, normally red states like Virginia in play, blue states in play for the Republicans. It is all over the place, this thing. But I think the debates that will come this fall, when the two candidates are formally nominated, the debates this fall will be critical in how this election turns. Senator Obama, even though he's gotten a lot of publicity, obviously, since he got the nomination, is still very much of an unknown. People want to size him up. Senator McCain is certainly outside of the Republican mainstream, the very thing that made him suspect in Republican circles. It's the very thing that may enable him to win in this environment today. So two critical domestic issues. One is energy, particularly offshore drilling. Not a popular thing in this state, but in the United States, very, very popular. And to the surprise of Republicans, it is a cutting issue in their favor, which is why last week Senator Obama started to make noises he might sign a bill with drilling allowed in it. Cutting issue, surprise issue of the year. Another big one is taxes. If Senator McCain pushes the tax issue, I think my own view is he's got a winning issue. If you take, for example, and I'm not sure Senator Obama fully realizes it yet, he certainly will early in this fall after Labor Day. If you take his proposal, for example, on raising the cap, eliminating the cap on Social Security for high-income earners, that would mean that the highest income tax, effective federal tax take on income would go up, this state of California, in excess of 60%. People haven't done the real arithmetic on that yet. If Senator McCain hammers that, I think he's going to have a winning issue on that. So watch what happens on those two critical issues. The energy one is the surprise one. No party anticipated that would cut the way it has this year. The other one I think will be coming up is the tax issue. My own view on taxes is that the federal income tax code is just an abomination that's a huge dead weight on the American economy. Just quickly to put it in perspective, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which defined the character of the American nation, 268 words in length. Talk about good editing. Declaration of Independence, mostly Thomas Jefferson's work, 1,300 words. Constitution, 5,000 words. The Bible took centuries to put together, 773,000 words. Now, you take the federal income tax code, all of its attendant rules and regulations, 9 million words and rising. And nobody knows what's in the thing. You don't have to go to the Amazon to find exotic creatures. They're crawling around this thing. The tax collectors don't know. You call their hotline, 25-30% of the time they'll give you the wrong answer, hold you responsible. But they don't know what's in the thing many times. And then a few years ago, Money Magazine did a survey, just for fun. They took a hypothetical family's finances, gave the numbers to 45 different tax preparers, experts in the field, asked them to prepare that family's tax return, and you know what they got back. 45 different returns, 45 different estimates of what the family owed, thousands of dollars of difference. The experts sometimes get tripped up on this thing. And so I think when you look at things like spending 6.5 billion hours a year filling out tax forms, look at all the wasted energy, angst, brain power on this thing. It's the biggest source of corruption in Washington. Half the lobbying revolves around the tax code. Infects and pollutes everything we do. I think we just should take this monstrosity, kill it, drive a stake through its heart, bury it, and hope it never rises again. Just simply start all over again. And I'd replace it with a simple flat tax, single rate, 17%, would apply after generous exemptions for adults and for dependents and children. Family of four, for example, no tax on your first $46,000 of income. No tax on savings, and no death taxes. I believe you should be allowed to leave the world unmolested by the IRS. Or as our founders might say, no taxation without respiration. And on the business side, we have now the second highest tax in the world. Lower our profits tax to 17%. Get rid of depreciation schedules. If you make a capital investment, write it off in the year in which you make it. If you have a loss, carry forward against future profits to use the thing up. You simplify the thing like that, I think you'll see this economy take off like a rocket as we apply our brains and do things for the right reasons, not for trying to get around the shoals or manipulate the tax code. 25 countries have done it in recent years, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe. Where it's been tried, it works. They get more collections because of its simplicity. If you make it, you pay it. Also, the lower rates make it more worthwhile for people to do productive things like productive work, taking risks, and moving ahead. So this is not a laboratory thing, an academic thing. It's working in the real world. Eventually, I hope someday we'll do the same thing. So on the economic side, we do have a crisis, self-made crisis. The core of it is the weak dollar. You cannot have a strong economy with a weak currency. If weak money was the way to wealth, ladies and gentlemen, Zimbabwe and Argentina would own the world today. It just does not work. And I thought we'd learned that lesson 30 years ago. We're having to learn it again. And I hope whoever wins the election in November will realize, as John Kennedy did, as Ronald Reagan did, a strong currency is essential to moving ahead and get this thing back on track. Now, one thing out there that you should be aware of, and then we'll get to the Q&A, and that is, and it's also roiling the oil markets. It hasn't been, it's sort of been touched on, but really hasn't been, I think, given proper emphasis. And that is Iran. The mullahs there are determined to get the bomb. The Europeans are willing to go along with it. So are the Russians and the Chinese. So is our State Department. But the Israelis are not. They see this, rightly, I think, as an existential issue. They're not going to let the murderous mullahs get the bomb. Time is running out. Diplomacy's been tried for 4 years. And next year, the Russians will be delivering to Iran an anti-aircraft system that'll if the Israelis ever decide to strike, a much more difficult operation. The Israeli intelligence sources believe Iran will have a nuclear device by the end of next year. Our own intelligence community believes it'll be a little longer. But with an anti-aircraft system coming in, just a matter of time before they get the device. They have the missiles to deliver the device. They can reach Europe, and won't be long before they can reach the United States. But everyone knows their real target is Israel. I think the Israelis are going to move. That's why if you look at the oil markets, you see a huge spike in November. The oil markets are starting to price this in. What happens if the Gulf is closed because of turbulence and military warfare there? Ships have a tankers have a hard time getting through. That's the big, big unknown out there. And we'll see it after the November elections. I believe the Israelis may very well strike between the elections and the inauguration of a new U.S. president if they don't feel the United States is going to take decisive action. Short of warfare, we could impose a blockade on Iran. They import 40% of their gasoline into Iran. They have the crude oil, but they can't process it. Their economy is now very weak. Unemployment's very high, even though they've gotten windfall revenues from high oil prices. They've made a hash of the economy. So you could, if you imposed real sanctions or a blockade, that government could fall on its own. But watch out for Iran. That is the big unknown out there, and one that is, I think, going to come to the fore sooner rather than later. Eventually, if the worst comes to worst there, oil will spike up. Eventually, the thing will be resolved, as these things are. But who knows what will happen short term. It'll be highly turbulent. But bottom line, if you look at the fundamentals around the world, even though we've got a crisis in Iran, even though we're making a hash of monetary policy here, the fundamentals are still positive. If we get through these things, you are going to see a continuation of what's begun several years ago of all parts of the world trying to achieve, as Lincoln put it, trying to improve one's lot in life, which is what people like to do, try to make things better for themselves and for their children and their communities. That process, a very positive one, I think even though it can be set back from time to time, is one that is going to move forward, and we're going to have a much better world in which to live despite these short-term crises. Thank you.
Our thanks to Steve Forbes, Chairman and Chief Executive of Forbes, Inc., and Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Magazine. A reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker is Mr. Forbes. Mr. Forbes, we do have a number of questions, so we'll get started. You alluded to the fact that the world economy certainly plays a central role today, yet America continues to be very strong in the holdings that we have. What are the opportunities for the U.S. as the other countries around the world strengthen their economies, and what are the effects of a strengthening dollar for those of us who are here in the U.S., particularly the working class?
Let me start with the integrity of the U.S. dollar. If the dollar stops declining, if we stabilize the thing as we did in the 1980s, as we did in the 1960s, what you will start to see happen is people will start to put the money productively to use again. If the money's going to go down in value, people tend to hold it to see what is going to happen. When they have a stable value for the dollar, then you start to see business investment go up and the economy really starts to improve. Again, printing the money is not going to improve the economy. Spending money by the government's not going to improve the economy. Japan tried that in the 90s. It didn't work. You got to get the currency stabilized. Economists and a lot of people disagree with this, but the dollar should be stable in value. It should be a stable measurement of value. For example, just let's be simple about it, Jeff. An hour has 60 minutes. Now imagine what would happen if you floated the clock. So an hour had 60 minutes one day, 70 the next, 40 the next, 80 the next. Why, you'd soon have to have derivatives and futures and hedges to figure out how many hours you're working each day. Or take a house. Let's say you floated the ruler. So you have 12 inches and a foot one day, 10 the next, 15 the next, 18 the next, 7 the next. It makes it very hard to build a house. The same thing is true of money. If it's going all over the place, you just have to hedge against that changing value, which means you can't focus on productive tasks at hand. And so it's highly, highly distortive. So strengthening the dollar works. It is much better for the economy. Then price signals mean something. We can then do something rational on the energy front and not have to worry, is this just a temporary bubble? Or it just is very distorting. So stabilize the dollar is number one. In terms of U.S. competing in this global economy, the key, and that's one reason why I think we got to simplify the tax code so we can focus on productive things and not waste brain power on stupid things like thousands of pages of incomprehensible gibberish that they write in Washington, is we can compete. And we've always competed in the past on value added, not doing what everyone else does, but doing new things. A classic example is in the late 1980s. In those days, it looked like the chip industry in the U.S. was going down. Intel was in trouble, closing plants. The Koreans and the Japanese could make the commodity chip cheaper than we could. The world looked like it was coming to an end. Then we did the value added. We started to develop architecture of chips that were highly advanced, which means you could charge more for them, far more productive. And so even if a Korean company like Samsung might make a chip cheaper, they couldn't make this high-value chip that Intel and others started to do. And as a result, we dominated the industry. And so that's what we have to do. Always stay ahead, value added. And also think of how you do small things in life. Classic case, we all know it, the company's in trouble right now, but it's had a good long run. As you ask yourself, in terms of innovation, it's not just high tech, it's using high tech or just taking something old and doing something new with it or reinventing it. A classic case, you ask yourself, what is the most common, one of the most common commodities in the world today is coffee. Anyone can make it. Everyone sells it. Even the airlines still serve a version of it for free. I don't know for how long, but still do. And yet what has been one of the most successful companies until recently was Starbucks. Taking something, and it's amazing. They take a shot of espresso, throw in steamed milk, call it latte, and people like me and their competitors do the same thing. People like me line up and pay $3 or $4 or $5 for this stuff. We love the atmosphere and all that. So that kind of innovation, not just in high tech, and everywhere, is how we've traditionally moved ahead. And one other example, which is instructive, is ask yourself, who made the most money from one of the biggest inventions of World War II, the mainframe computer, originally designed to help artillery officers more quickly calculate where the shells were going to go. Obviously, computers had much more application than artillery shells. But who made the most money from it? It wasn't IBM's competitors. They all went by the wayside, like RCA. IBM itself nearly went under in the early 1990s. The one company made most money from the mainframe computer was Sam Walton at Walmart. Early 1960s, small Northwest Arkansas retailer at the time, Kresge Kmart, 50 times the size of Walmart. How do you beat the big boys at the business? Sam Walton figured out that if he used computers, used specialized software, managed inventories, information better than his competitors, he could beat them at their game, managing inventories better, getting suppliers to get their acts together, and the rest is history. So it can apply anywhere. Traditional industries using new things, creating new industries, as Intel effectively did starting in the late 80s, that's how you stay ahead. Very important to keep in mind. We are competitive when we have a chance to put our minds to it. We've been doing it for 200 years, not trying to make things cheaper than anyone else. or cutting wages 95%. It's figuring out value added. Innovation, absolutely key, innovation.
You touched on the flat tax and talked a little about that. What are the barriers, and how does the American public engage itself to get it adopted?
Well, the barriers to the flat tax are that a lot of people are doing very well with the system. In Washington, they're very comfortable with the system as we have it today because it is a source of power and a massive source of contributions. Anyone who wants to do anything about the tax code, you write checks to the members of the Ways and Means Committee and others to get, quote, access. So, and then you have the IRS, 100,000 agents. They don't mind the current system. H&R Block, when I ran for president in 1996, they sent a mailing to the voters of New Hampshire warning of the impending end of civilization if something like this happened. And so I think what we have, and one of the ways you get around it is, see, the flat tax is so simple, you don't need all of these deductions. It's a tax cut without all of these deductions. But they try to use fear on you, saying you're going to lose your home deduction, you're going to lose this, you're going to lose that. And so if you want to put the system in, especially in a country like the United States, I think you have to give people a choice. And Hong Kong is a variation of this. They've been doing it 60 years. And that is, when you put the new system in, you give people a choice. You can file under the new system, single page, or if you wish, you can stay with the old system. See for yourself which one is better. So that way you don't get hung up. I'm going to lose this, I'm going to lose that. Don't worry about it. See for yourself. Do your own arithmetic. See how it works out. And that way I think you get away from the opposition to it. And part of the opposition is ideological. Why have a single rate when you can have 5 or 10 rates? You make more, your rate goes up even higher. And my feeling is that just breeds complexity, breeds corruption. If you make it, pay it, and you end up collecting more. Countries that put in a simple system find collections are much easier to enforce, and so you get better growth and you get better compliance. And I think if we do that, I think it would be a wholesome thing in the U.S. But what can you do? First, call your representative and ask, what are you doing to simplify the tax code? Now, you'll get an aide who will tell you how happy they are to hear from you, not. But if enough people do it, they're going to start to pay attention. We have to do it ourselves. We got to get candidates to do it. And some of us are working on that. And the candidates that do it, I think, are going to realize they've tapped into something huge. No one, I don't care what party you are, what ideology you are, most people realize this thing has got no rationale whatsoever, and we've got to find a better way to do it.
Some are concerned in the audience about what might happen to housing values and charities and others under flat tax system. Can you comment on that?
Yes, under the flat tax, if people choose to go that way when they have the choice, you would find, first of all, housing would be strengthened. Think of it. If you're allowed to keep more of what you earn, your savings are not taxed, so interest rates come down. This has been the experience. Isn't that good for housing? More income, lower interest rates, so easier to do a monthly mortgage. I think that helps the housing industry, not hurt it. Most people like the idea that at some point, if they wish, they can buy where they live. So a higher income, lower monthly payments go hand in hand. On the charitable side, a lot of charities believe that if you lower tax rates, people won't give as much. Actually, experience shows that the amount that people give in charity, charitable contributions each year, does not vary regardless of the tax code. It's roughly, we give here in the United States, roughly 2%, equivalent 2% of the economy, economic activity, 2% of GDP, each year to charitable contributions. In good years, it may go a little higher than 2, bad years, a little lower than 2, but for decades, it's been around that level. And what experience shows is that people are earning more, they will give more. For example, in the 1980s, when we cut the top income tax rate in the U.S. from 70 down to 28%, a lot of charitable institutions opposed that, figuring that's going to hurt giving, because after all, if the rate is 70% and you give a dollar to charity, in fact, Uncle Sam's paying 70 cents of it. Whereas if the rate is 28, Uncle Sam's only subsidizing you 28 cents, so you may not write a bigger check. But when those rates went down in the 1980s, what happened was charitable giving went up, and the rate of growth of charitable giving went up. When people have more, they give more. So the level depends on the wealth of the economy, not on tax rates. So I believe with a flat tax, you'll get a better economy, which means there'll be more philanthropic giving.
A couple more questions on taxes, and then we'll move on. One person in the audience wants to know, why should we tax business at all? Why not just tax individuals?
The idea of not taxing businesses is not quite as crazy as it sounds when you realize that if the taxes that business pay, where do they get the money? They get it from the customer, i.e. people. So they're just a conduit, but it's politically it sounds nice. Oh, we'll get business to pay like they're getting the money off a tree or something. No, they're getting it from our pockets. Politically, I think it's just a tough thing to do now that it's been embedded for decades. So what I'd like to do is simply lower the rate to 17 from 35%. Not punish people who make capital investments, which is how we stay ahead on value added and productivity, and not get in a debate about embedded costs and the like. Maybe we can get the flat tax. Maybe then we can have the debate about embedded costs. But in the meantime, just a hard thing for people to get their arms around, get their minds around the idea that when you buy something, like you go out and buy a tie or a pair of shoes or dress or skirt or whatever, you're not just buying the product. You're also, in effect, paying the taxes that business pay. It's in the price you pay. It's not just a sales tax. It's also all the other taxes that business are in. It's embedded in the price. But that's a hard concept. So I'll go with the flat tax first, and then we can go on to the next debate.
Final question on taxes. What happens to inheritance taxes and or capital gains taxes if Obama wins or if McCain wins?
On the capital gains tax, the Obama campaign the other day made it clearer than he had been before that he would raise the rate, capital gains levy, from 15% to 28%. And on inheritance taxes, he hasn't really been explicit yet, but clearly he wants them. Senator McCain has not addressed specifically the inheritance tax, except to say he likes a lower one. But his colleague from Arizona, Senator Kyle, who once was in favor of abolishing it, realized that might not work and proposed a reform where they'd lower the rate and raise the exemptions. So I think that would probably be a path that Senator McCain would take. By the way, right now, unless they change the law next year, and only Washington would do this, the death tax disappears in the United States on the federal level in 2010. It goes from about 45% to zero for 1 year. Then in 2011, it comes back at 55%. So if any of your heirs suggest to you in 2010 a trip to Holland, say no. The Dutch have legalized euthanasia. And it's true, they sometimes don't ask the patient about it. So if your heir suggests a trip to Amsterdam, you may end up looking at the tulips from an angle you had not anticipated. Just stay home.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Steve Forbes, chairman and CEO of Forbes Incorporated and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine, who's discussing the state of the U.S. economy as well as the current political climate. Speaking about the political race, if you were a business school professor and had Obama and McCain in your class, would either pass the course?
I presume if they're in the class that they're there to learn. So I'd hope after the class I would say they both passed, especially on the tax side. It is very hard for a lot of people, and certainly in the political cultures, and this is not just true in the United States, true around the world, to grasp that taxes are not just a means of raising revenue. They're also a price and a burden. And if you think of it this way, that the tax you pay in income is the price you pay for working, tax on profits, the price you pay for being successful, tax on capital gains, the price you pay for taking risks that work out. I think you quickly realize that if you lower the price of good things like productive work, risk-taking, success, you get more of those good things, raise the price, you get less of them. And that's why, for example, the tax rebates, which just went out a couple of months ago, were, to be blunt about it, a waste of money. It was nice to get the check, especially when it clears from the government. But now they're discovering it's a one-shot. Nice to get the check. You might buy a washing machine. You might pay down some debt. You might just clutch the cash, whatever. But it's a one-shot, and then you're back to where you were. What do you do for an encore? Whereas when you lower tax rates, then behavior changes. People take more risks. And you look at the housing market. Now, the Federal Reserve threw it off track in 2004, but in 1998, the Republican passed and the Democratic president signed a tax bill on housing that effectively exempted much of the capital gains from your primary residence from tax. Effectively raised it to $500,000 if you're a couple. So if you sold your primary residence, your first $500,000 gain, free of tax. And guess what happened to housing prices? They went up, broke the norm of the previous years because suddenly the asset had less of a burden, became more valuable. It's true for securities as well. So that's what I'd hammer home. The other thing I'd hammer home to the two candidates, and that most boring subject, monetary policy, stable money, strong money, better than weak money. If they understand those two things about taxes and money, I'll gladly give them an A+.
Let's move on to the fiscal crisis that we're in, and a lot of folks have been asking questions related to regulating the speculation in the oil commodities market, speculation in the stock market. What is your view of regulating the automated computers, essentially, that are doing a lot of the trading these days, and how, if we were to do that, how would it work in a very complex landscape?
The thing about, and this gets to one of the aftermaths of when you have a cheapening money, when you have inflation, is there's a tendency to start shooting the messenger or people who react to it. It's not speculators per se who are driving up the price of oil or driving down the value of stocks. It's the depreciating value of the dollar. If the dollar was stable, speculators would go on to other activities. If you banned speculation in oil, oil would still be at a high price. If you banned speculation or short selling in equities, you'd still have probably even more turbulence in the stock market. Now, you can have more openness. I think getting rid of the uptick rule was a mistake in the stock market, whereas you can't sell a security short unless it has gone up in price. Instead of just driving the thing relentlessly down, I don't know why they took that rule away. I'd bring that back. So sensible things on disclosure, things like uptick rules, fine. But the nubbin of it is what you're seeing is the aftermath of inflation. Now, part of it in the oil markets, I think, is truly related to Iran. How much? $20, $30 a barrel, anticipation something may go wrong in the Gulf. But a big part of oil prices since 2003 is inflation. Just to put in perspective, Jeff, in 2003, oil was $25 to $28 a barrel. In those days, an ounce of gold would buy you about 11, 12 barrels of oil. Today, an ounce of gold will buy you about 8 or 9 barrels of oil. So the real price of oil has gone up, but maybe 50%, but not 200%, 300%. So rather than focusing on speculators and things like that, let's get to the real cause, and then we can clean up these other things.
As you look at the landscape, what do you think of T. Boone Pickens' strategy for energy?
You've probably seen, if you watch cable, T. Boone Pickens talking about wind. And wind can play a role. He's proposing to make it easier to do transmission lines for wind, to have wind farms in Texas. And there's a corridor in the United States going up from Texas up to the north to the Dakotas that is generally very windy. So if you put wind farms along that corridor, you have transmission lines, it could be a useful source of power. And the fact that he's willing to put his own money into the farms, he's already done it in Texas, I say good on him. And if he can come up with ways of doing the transmission lines, go right ahead and mobilize the capital to do it. The challenge with wind farms is it just takes a lot of acreage to get the windmills that can do the energy, but it has a role to play. It won't replace. I don't think he's right that it'll replace all our needs for natural gas, but it can be useful. And that's the thing in a free economy, is it's going to be a lot of things out there, not just one silver bullet's going to do the things. And who knows what's going to come along? I mean, I don't want to be Pollyannish on this thing, but we are going to consume more energy if we want to grow. But in terms of sources, innovation is a very potent force. Just think of it. Who 20 years ago had ever heard of the Internet? If you had had a spell check from the late 1980s and typed in Internet, it would say no such word. Or who 10 years ago heard of an iPod? Now, certainly younger people, we can't live without the thing. And it's made Apple a major company again. So these things come from the most unlikely places. So I think the key thing is if you have an environment where people are willing like do Boone Pickens and put your money on the line and try to do this, remove the barriers. Let them have at it. We'll see what works.
Can you talk about, in your own arena, the process that you go about when you are compiling, in this case, your healthiest individuals list? And are you surprised by the people who end up on it?
In terms of the wealthiest, it is always full of surprises, and especially in the global area. I mentioned we're in the midst of a global boom, even though right now it's slowing down. I believe long-term it will continue. And what it shows, again, is when you look at certainly the global list of the richest people in the world, is most of them are doing it on their own. There's very little inherited wealth in there. And it's coming from the most unlikely places. And so in that sense, I think it underscores the importance of removing barriers to the innovators. And one thing that certainly my brothers and I grew up with is that today's success does not mean tomorrow's success. You always have to work at the thing. Right now, we were discussing it before we came out here, Jeff and I, what the Internet has done to roil the media industry. You see it on newspapers. No one anticipated in the industry 3 years ago the turmoil and turbulence that they're being hit with now. As more and more people in the morning, first thing they do is they go online. They don't pick up a newspaper anymore. And you see it with, just give you one example, Minneapolis Star Tribune, bought 11 years ago by, I think it was McClatchy, $1.2 billion, sold a little 2 years ago, $500 million. 10-year, $700 million loss. The equity fund that bought it just notified a few months ago their clients. They're writing down that investment 75%, 90% loss. And yet in the net industry itself, Google's booming. Other parts are struggling. So the list reflects that. It is fluid, ongoing. And just because you have it today doesn't mean you're going to have it tomorrow. So they're always, each year, 15-20%. New names, and most names you never heard of. We were the first, when we did this list in the early 80s, to discover Sam Walton. No one had ever heard of this guy before. Boom, biggest retailer in the world.
As you look at the landscape and certainly the positive energy Forbes and its magazine and publications bring to the landscape, does the idea of a business-driven Peace Corps as a civilian branch of service ring positive with you?
Well, I think that getting business practices out there is a good thing. And as you know, somebody actually won a Nobel Peace Prize for the idea of promoting micro lending. and that is breaking away from traditional banking and lending to mostly women $50, $100, $150 to do initially small projects paid off in a way that normal banks hadn't seen. And what you saw in microlending and that kind of and what that teaches people who get the loan in terms of creating a business to repay that loan, turning out a product, getting it to market, and that sort of thing, is the best teacher possible. Experience teaches you very, very quickly in the real world. And by the way, what happened on microlending was really an extension of what A.P. Giannini did in San Francisco a little over 100 years ago when he started first the Bank of Italy, then became Bank of the United States, was at the time banks dealt with wealthy customers and companies. They didn't deal with normal individuals. And he saw loan sharks preying on sailors on the waterfront and thought, there's an opportunity here. And by emphasizing services, you know, the classic case after the earthquake in 1906, he set up a box and was open for business while the others were closed. Microlending, going to customers that no one else had served before, he ended up creating the largest bank in the world. And so microlending is simply an extension of realizing their opportunities. And again, that is the best experience. So a core depends what the core does, but the enabling people to have the experience and the sometimes failure. Failure is sometimes a painful teacher. But if you don't have a system that tolerates or lets you suffer failure from time to time, you're not going to get the successes, but people aren't going to take the risks. Most new businesses don't succeed. So again, the key thing is having that environment where people can take risks and you don't have a social stigma for failure. Almost in Silicon Valley, if you haven't had some scars, they don't think you're for real. You got to have an environment that allows those scars because that's how you get the iPods and the great advances in the future that we can't even imagine today.
I think another side to that question really dealt with the fact that we have a many millions of baby boomers getting ready to leave the business world. Would their talents be useful out there pro bono?
I think what's going to happen as my generation, and I love to be called now baby boomer, you know, it's kind of nice, look at the mirror. Baby, yes. But I think what you're going to find with a lot of baby boomers, health permitting, is they may retire from one thing, but they're going to be very busy on other things. And thanks to high technology, you can do businesses with your fingertips no matter where you are. And I forget what the number is, but I think on eBay, 400,000 people make their living selling stuff on eBay or equivalents of the eBays of the world. And I think baby boomers are going to be very active. So whether they set up their own business or whether they consulting business or do a pro bono, I don't think most of that capital, you might say, which is knowledge, is going to remain unused for very long. If you have your health, people are going to want to be active about it. So I think you'll see a lot of things happening in non-traditional ways when that 77 million cohort moves from traditional lines of work.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Steve Forbes, chairman and CEO of Forbes Incorporated and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. And Mr. Forbes, you give kind of perspectives and advice in your regular column, but some in our audience want to know, what would you say is the best personal strategy today to cope with stagflation?
The best personal strategy, other than reading Forbes and Forbes.com. Got to get a plug. But seriously, the best strategy is, depending, you know, all the caveats, where you are in life, all that sort of thing, best strategy is realize your emotions are your enemy. And in an environment like this, the tendency is, got to get out, is it too late to get out? Just as a few years ago, the tendency was, is it too late to get in? Got to get in, got to get in. And so everyone preaches discipline, everyone believes in diversification, long-term strategy until the market goes kablooey, either on the upside or the downside. So if you have a strategy, my best advice is if you're working, set aside a certain amount each month, even if the market is in the proverbial you-know-what, keep putting that in. Just make sure your funds, if you can't babysit the money yourself, you have low-cost funds, low-expense funds, so you don't get eaten up there, and just put in a certain amount each month. diversify, and you're not trying to hit Grand Slam home runs. You're just trying to just move ahead. A money market fellow years ago put it very well. He said, most of us are not going to play in tournaments like Wimbledon. So if you're an amateur tennis player, just focus on getting the bloody ball over the net. Don't try to be fancy about it. Just get it over the net, and you'll do okay. Same thing in money. Just get over the net. Don't try to hit grand slams. Don't get persuaded in cocktail parties or when you meet friends about what geniuses they are. In an up market, everyone's a genius. In a down market, everyone's a bum. And so just do it a little bit amount each month, and you'll do fine. And if you're later in life, be realistic when you might think you need assets. And one of the things you should look at, especially if you're my age, very carefully, because there's some good stuff out there and there's some bad stuff, is long-term care insurance. As we live longer, we may need that thing, and better have some backstop on that, given the vicissitudes of the world.
Looking at the landscape, we've seen the demise of Bear Stearns. What, in your mind, led to their demise, and are there others in line to follow?
What did Bear Stearns in was they did go whole hog in this new stuff. But if you looked at their balance sheet at the beginning of March of this year in a business school class, you'd have said some dicey stuff, but okay. Their mistake was they didn't recapitalize when they realized they had a problem in late 2007. And so when the rumors start, and almost every firm other than Goldman has been hit by rumors, if you haven't had that recapitalization, they just take on a life of their own. Don't hold me to the exact numbers, but the beginning of March, Bear had a little over $22 billion in cash. By mid-March, it was down to about $12 or $13 billion. And then in one day, they lost $8 to $10 billion in cash. It was on a Thursday. From $12 billion to $3 billion, they called up the SEC and the Fed and said, it's over. We can't continue. Every bank, especially every Wall Street bank, each morning gets lines of credit from banks. So if those lines aren't there, you are kaput no matter how sound your balance sheet or anything else. So it was a combination of panic, mistakes by Bear in not shoring up their balance sheets, as Merrill and others continuously do. So when the storm hit them in particular, they were very vulnerable to the rumors, and they went under. What made it even added to it, and you saw it play out with Fannie and Freddie recently, is that when the Fed came in, our Treasury Department made it quite clear that they wanted the shareholders to take a wipeout. So when Bear, a couple of years ago, stock was 170, ended up selling at 10 when J.P. Morgan bought the thing. So when, and that meant that the rescue of Bear, so to speak, was no bailout for shareholders. They got wiped out, as did the employees. What that meant was that when Fannie and Freddie, the rumors started to hit them a few weeks ago, everyone fled the stocks. They didn't flee the bonds, but they figured, oh, my God, that stock's going to be wiped out. Get out while the getting's good. So it's pure, it's emotions, and it can hit anybody. And so, again, if you're an institution, head of an institution, make sure you recapitalize before you have to. And if you're a policymaker, i.e., you're Hank Paulson or Ben Bernanke, please restore the integrity of the U.S. dollar, and then we can finally get this thing behind us and pick up the pieces and move on.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and there are several in the audience that want to find out your sense of who ought to be picked for vice president for Mr. McCain, and would you be willing to serve?
For Mr. McCain, he won't offer it to me, because if he did, I would accept it. And and as for the VP picks for both candidates, they traditionally, certainly since Lyndon Johnson was the last vice president to bring a state to the ticket, and don't ask how he delivered Texas, he did it for John Kennedy, but candidates try to use the VP pick to reassure doubters in independence. So in the case of Senator Obama, in experience than resume. I think he would be wise to go with somebody like a Senator Nunn, even though he's going to have problems with certain constituencies in the Democratic Party. He is a military man, a Nunn, or at least served in the Senate Armed Services Committee, so he can reassure people that Senator Obama will have a sound team around him, blah, blah, blah. A wild choice for Senator Obama, which won't happen, but if you think about it, I think would be a knockout, even though you shake your head at the beginning, would be, if he could persuade him, General Powell. On the military side, foreign policy side, take care of those doubts right away. For Senator McCain, his challenge is establishing true independence from the current administration, even though he is independent of it, as they can tell you. One wild choice would be Senator Lieberman of Connecticut. Republican leaders would probably gulp and accept it just because Lieberman's not going to lead the Republican Party. He's not going to take anyone's place. And that would certainly, Senator Lieberman's a man now with virtually without a party, so show that Senator McCain, true independent. Senator McCain's also wrapped on his age. He would be the oldest serving president if he's elected. So he might throw a wild one and go with somebody like Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana, who served in Congress, now governor of Louisiana, and did something unprecedented in Louisiana, passed an ethics law. Louisiana, ethics, politics. And in between, you have a number of governors that Senator McCain, Pawlenty of Minnesota, Chris to Florida, Barbara of Mississippi, former Governor Romney, whole slew of others, Tom Ridge, former governor, Homeland Secretary, whole slew of people. He might go with somebody like Governor Palin, Sarah Palin of Alaska, or maybe Kay Bailey of Texas. But somebody younger, has executive experience because he's a senator, so he wants to show that he's got youth and some executive experience with him. So it's try to reassure the doubters and the independents. That's what they're both looking at. Senator Obama may go with somebody more traditional, like Governor Kaine of Virginia, in the hopes of that's a red state that's very much in play for the Democrats this year. Try to shore that one up. We'll know in a couple of weeks after the Olympics. But trying to reassure the undecided voters, that's what both are going to be focusing on in the next couple of weeks.
Our thanks to Steve Forbes, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Forbes Incorporated and Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Magazine. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jeff Clark, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.